Hello and welcome to the Funds Fanatic Show. I'm thrilled to be joined on the podcast today by Lion Trust's Peter Michaelis and Simon Clements, who together run the firm's rapidly growing £15 billion range of sustainable funds. With ESG and concurrent concerns about greenwashing remaining all the rage, I'm looking forward to hearing from Simon and Peter what the future of investing looks like, and indeed whether investors really can continue to do well by doing good as value stocks and sectors like oil and gas start to enjoy a stronger run. Peter, Simon, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having us.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast today. I suppose let's start with you, Peter. First things first, can you tell us a bit more about what you do and how long you've been doing it?
Okay, I've been managing sustainable investment funds for more than 20 years now. That's always, to me, it was the only style of investment I've ever been involved in. And to me, I've always been attracted by the idea that it just seems to make sense. The idea that companies which are giving us more of the good stuff that we want more of will do better longer term. And so day to day, I manage the team. I'm also lead manager on our multi-asset funds and our UK strategies.
Excellent. Well, that's interesting to hear. You've only ever worked on sustainable funds. How about you, Simon? What's your background and how did you come to this?
Yeah, so I've been managing the funds now since the end of 2010. So it's been managing the funds like going on 12 years. I've been on the team since 2009. So previous to that, I actually ran global thematic funds alongside Peter at Aviva Investors. So I was really interested in running kind of sustainable equities. It's something that kind of always appealed to me, and I was offered the chance to come and work for Peter and run the global funds. It was a chance that I kind of jumped at.
Excellent. And just to be clear, the sustainable future funds have a bit of an interesting history. Of course, you're at Lion Trust now, but the funds have kind of moved around a couple of times. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, the badge over the top has changed a couple of times, but I think what's important is that the team running them and the philosophy and the proposition has remained constant over the last 21 years.
Okay, thank you. Now, I think there are 14 sustainable future funds, and as you said, there are equity funds, which you run, also fixed income funds and multi-asset funds balancing both. Now, we can't possibly cover all of that today, so I think we're going to, if it's all right, if we can speak mostly to the Sustainable Future Global Growth Fund. So that's your process, which looks at global equities, and then the UK Growth Fund. Maybe that will give us a more manageable universe to look at. But just first thing on that, am I right in saying, so Peter, you look more at the UK equities and Simon, you look more at the global equities?
That's right, yeah. But they have and all of our strategies have the same process underpinning them.
Yeah. Okay. And so Simon, I mentioned in the intro this word or this phrase ESG, environment, social, and governance criteria. We hear this term constantly today. Am I right in saying that when you guys, as you've been building this process, that certainly wasn't always the case?
Yeah, I mean, as a team, we were kind of one of the earliest established, sustainability teams, kind of doing this. So when we first started managing the money, it definitely wasn't kind of mainstream. It was definitely more niche. I think we always believed that, there was always a huge appeal to investors of, for products that, take these kind of factors into account. We always felt that these factors were important in terms of, the value of companies. And we felt that the kind of, as we kind of, as the world changes and the economy changes to become more sustainable over time, that these kind of factors would become more and more important. And we have been pleased that, that has played out. It's played out in terms of driving performance of the funds, which, if you look at our fund performance over the long term, it's very, very good. But also in terms of, investor interest and investor demand, which has been reflected by, the kind of growth in assets in the last kind of five years or so.
Yeah. And you mentioned you're one of the first teams to really start looking at this area on a large scale. What have been some of the main things you've learned about sustainable investing in the last 10 years, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, well, we've learned that as with kind of the adoption of a lot of things, you know, some things can, you know, the kind of adoption, you know, things happen much more rapidly than you kind of think they do. So things don't happen in a linear fashion. Mm-hmm. They can go from, you know, being appearing not to be of much interest to all of a sudden being a kind of, you know, of huge interest. And we kind of find that with anything kind of disruptive and, you know, it's, you know, a lot of the technology we invest in as well. So, you know, I think that sometimes investors and like to think in kind of, you know, things happen like slowly and in a linear way, but actually things can happen slowly, then very, very quickly. And we found that, yeah. we find that, as I say, in things we look at, whether that be the adoption of things like renewable energy, but also, you know, it's happened within the kind of idea of, you know, interest and importance placed on ESG factors within investing, but also, you know, sustainable investment products and assets. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, what we've noticed. And I wouldn't say we were surprised, but, you know, I think that, you know, the pace at which the interest kind of accelerated was something that you know, we were probably maybe slightly surprised by, but, you know, obviously pleasantly surprised.
Well, on that note, Peter, I mean, this ubiquitous capsule ESG, is it useful, or do you think it's so broad and ill-defined that it kind of helps greenwashing, helps these kind of fake sustainability approaches in some senses?
Yes. I mean, I think there is a risk that, because it's very easy to just sort of say we do ESG and then not change anything underneath, there is certainly the risk. So on the one hand, there is the risk that, you know, people just dust it on like a little bit of Parmesan
right
on top of the pasta. You know, but it's not the kind of whole meal that people are getting. So we think that it's really important for investment managers to be absolutely clear about how they're integrating sustainability or ESG into the way they manage their assets. Yeah. But also, I'm afraid buyers, you know, investors in their funds need to just sort of look under the bonnet a bit more.
Okay. Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's great. It's great that that awareness is out there, because there've certainly been periods in my career when you would talk about sustainability or environmental issues, and, you know, you were alone
in a would switch off
with some tumbleweed rolling through it. So, it has really kind of changed in terms of awareness. But you can understand there are successful asset managers who've, you know, built up large assets under management, and they're suddenly confronted with this, oh my God, we've got to do something with ESG. Let's do the minimum we can to get away with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, our
that's what you see
industry has to be very clear about in terms of being as transparent as possible about how sustainability is being used.
Yeah. Well, staying with you, Peter, it's fair to say not everyone's jumping on the bandwagon. Your fellow fund manager, Terry Smith, recently said that Unilever, so a company that you also hold, had lost the plot when it comes to sustainability. I think particularly memorably, he said they'd been trying to define a purpose for Hellmann's Mayo, which, you know, evinced some kind of confusion. I guess you think differently about that.
Yeah, it's a good catchphrase, but we do think differently. I mean, our broad idea, our macro view, is that our economies and societies progress. You know, they progress to become more efficient in their use of resources, deliver a healthier outcome to society, better quality of life, and become more resilient. And you can see that over hundreds of years. You know, child mortality is a statistic we talk about, where at the turn of the 20th century, if you had a kid, it had a 1 in 5 chance of making it to its 5th birthday in the UK. I mean, it's a tragic odds. Now it's more like 1 in 300, you know, a huge improvement. So the general rule that we believe is that if you're a business which is offering a product which is helping to make our lives better and to reduce our environmental impact, that, all other things being equal, we'll see stronger growth in demand. And because it's kind of quite a novel product, it's likely to see less competition, which are both great attributes for a business. And we, you know, we back companies that are doing that, and Unilever has a very strong track record of having done that. So we do see that differently, but it's clear that to be successful in the consumer goods market, you've got to produce stuff that the public wants more of, and healthier foods is one of those.
Okay. Well, Simon, turning to you, so I suppose Peter's told us a bit there about what kind of companies you're looking for, these companies that are on the right side of history, we might say. Can you tell us a bit more about, you know, the essence of the process? I mean, is do you take quite a broad view, and you're looking for these kind of big themes, or are you digging into very specific criteria about exactly what it means to be a sustainable company?
Yeah, well, we start with, you know, this idea that, you know, the economy is becoming more sustainable. We think that we can observe that. We think that, and we believe that the economy becomes more sustainable in three different ways that we can invest behind. We believe it becomes cleaner and more efficient. We also believe it becomes healthier, provides a better quality of life, and also becomes safer. Okay, and we start with that idea, and again, we're trying to look for companies that are benefiting from this change to become more sustainable, but also kind of, you know, allowing it to happen. Okay, and we believe that these companies, you know, they're on the right side of history. You know, that the goods and services that they sell, you know, the world's going to want more of, and more of in time. And so when you start with that idea, you know, and we have 21 different investment themes. So, you know, for instance, you know,
it's a lot.
Yeah. But there's, you know, there's lots of things to invest behind it. And we like the fact that we've got lots of themes, because, you know, we can invest in companies that, you know, that improve the energy efficiency of our economy. But we can also invest in companies that, you know, improve medical technology, or help save for the future. And these are kind of all, you know, they're not correlated with each other. So when one's doing well, the other one's not. So we have this breadth. We're not just dependent on, you know, what one area of the market doing well. Because, you know, inevitably, if you are like that, if you're very kind of, you know, channeled in one specific area, it's very difficult to perform well, you know, kind of broadly and all the time. And we love that we have this breadth, and we're trying to find a little thesis, you know, within the global economy as broadly as we can around the economy becoming more sustainable. And then we try to, that's kind of the first stage. And then we try to find the right companies, and companies that, you know, from a bottom up perspective, are sustainable in their own right. So not just this big picture kind of themes that they're benefiting on, but also look at the nuts and bolts of the business, you know, how they manage their environmental, social, and governance risk, things like, you know, culture, you know, incentives within the business, you know, what does the business stand for? What, you know, how do they treat their employees? And when you find those two together, and then you find companies that are actually brilliant businesses fundamentally. And then we look for companies that are also mispriced. And putting all those together, you know, we're trying to find, you know, within the global fund, for instance, we start with thousands, we're trying to find, you know, 45, 50 stocks or companies that, you know, over a 5-year view, you know, we feel, you know, with all these little different ingredients put together, can deliver performance. And that's really, you know, what we try to do, and the kind of, you know, we feel the secret to our success over the last kind of 2 decades.
Yeah, thanks. And so, Peter, I think, to tease that out a bit more, I think if most people heard this word sustainability and implied that to investing, they think, okay, so we're going to invest in the good guys here, the good corporate actors. Is that right, or is that a bit too simplistic a way to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to narrow down the field to those companies that hit that sort of sweet spot that they have as they grow. They do something positive for people on the planet. They can grow profitably in terms of the returns that they generate, and their share price, we believe, will appreciate, you know, taking that longer five-year, 10-year view. Yeah. So where those things come together, those are the companies that we invest behind.
Okay, because there will be companies in the portfolio that might raise some eyebrows. I mean, what one in your UK fund, one of the biggest holding is 3i, so that's the biggest private equity group in Britain. I mean, they're really at what you might call the sharp end of capitalism, right?
Well, I think, yeah, private equity maybe has that reputation, but 3i is a very different beast from that.
Okay.
Beast is probably the wrong word to use. Yeah, but 3i's, its very roots were after the war to invest behind industries, investment in industry. And it's focused very much on innovation, on medical technology, on kind of leaning consumer services businesses. It's a very, I mean, it's always had a responsibility embedded into, responsible investment embedded into how it invests. So it excludes certain sectors that it won't touch, like, you know, arms and tobacco, etc. It's been a signatory of the PRI since, you know, for over 10 years. And so it allows us to gain access to private investments, which we couldn't otherwise invest in. Yeah. And what we like about 3i, if it sort of links very closely to our approach, which is there's no fixed holding term. They hold things forever if necessary. And we think that that's part of the reason why private equity tends to get a bad name, is because they invest for sort of 7 years, and at the end they dress it up and put too much financial leverage, and it's all
sell off the assets, too much debt. Yeah,
that's not the 3i approach at all.
Okay, sure. And I promise not to do this with every holding in your funds, but Simon, another company that caught my eye, the top holding in the Global Growth Fund, Alphabet, so the owner of Google. Now, probably like anyone listening to this, I use Google without thinking and lots of their other free-to-use products every day. But any company that's that big, that powerful, that hoards so much of our consumer data, you've got to be asking hard questions, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And look, you know, Alphabet is a name that, you know, we do spend a lot of time, you know, trying to engage with them. We also speak to, we have an advisory committee that helps us. And let me just be clear, it's, you know, Alphabet is the only one of the kind of big tech stocks that we actually invest in. So we don't invest in things like Facebook and Amazon. But the reason that we feel that Alphabet is a sustainable company is, if you look at the core product and services of what they do, it really is that kind of, it's an algorithm that collects, you know, information that's out there and makes it accessible to everybody. So this idea that it's a democratization of information, and, you know, 85% of people that use Google do it for free. So, you know, we think it's a really important service. We think that it allows, you know, access to everybody to this information. There's no doubt whatsoever that that comes with a huge responsibility on their part. And, you know, it is a virtual, it's a monopoly based on the fact that, you know, it is obviously, you know, by far the most efficient product out there. So it really does control the market. So we spend a lot of time kind of looking at those things. You know, there's other parts of business. You know, YouTube is a business that they own that's also, you know, probably at the sharper end of what we're concerned about from a sustainability perspective. Clearly, the amount of content that goes over it, or the type of content that goes over it, and how they kind of, you know, police that is really important, how they take responsibility for it. So, you know, but, you know, also YouTube's, there's a lot of positive aspects to YouTube. You know, I learned how to, you know, fix my boiler using YouTube, for instance. I don't have to get the guy around to do it. So there's lots of things, teaches you to cook. So, you know, but obviously it's also slightly addictive, and, you know, anybody that's got kids knows that they love to kind of be on there. And so there is kind of, it's balancing those aspects. So the other aspect, there's other aspects we really like about Alphabet. So they have this other area called Other Bets. So they actually, 10% of their net income, they actually expense every year. And that's a lot of net income, if anybody knows how much Google earns. So Alphabet earns. So, and they own things like Verily, which is a life science company. So, you know, and there again, they're investing in things that, you know, with potential huge, huge benefits in the future, but don't make any money yet. They own Waymo, which is, you know, potentially the biggest player in autonomous driving. Again, doesn't make any money, but could really change the world. So, you know, we really looked at the kind of core culture of what we feel Alphabet stands for. We, you know, you go back, you can go and read all the letters. And, you know, we feel amongst the large tech stocks, because of what that core business is, and these kind of positives that do outweigh the negatives. We've got some negatives, you know, that we don't like the tax aspect of what they do. We don't like, you know, the corporate governance isn't ideal in our perspective, despite, you know, the fact that we believe there is a benevolence to the way that the companies run. So we will assess these all as an individual company, and Alphabet's the one that we think on balance is a sustainable business. But it's, you know, there's no doubt it's probably the company that we get, you know, most questions about within the global fund. But, you know, again, we have a process that we go through, and, you know, we're always happy to defend it in front of clients, which we often do.
Can I, on the corporate governance aspect, this may not be exactly what you're talking about, but well, this is a question for both of you, really. I think I'm right in saying Alphabet's founders, you know, they might own about 10% of the company today, but they control a majority of the shareholder votes via a special share class. What do you think about that? I mean, this is becoming an interesting topic in the UK too, because some people think that, you know, if we want to develop a listed tech sector in the UK, we need more of these kinds of structures where the founders retain control. What do you think?
I mean, the general thing that we, and Simon can talk specifically about, but the general thing we have when we're looking at corporate governance is we want to be aware of the risks and any peculiarities or distinctiveness. And then the question we ask is, you know, will this affect us as minority shareholders, or do we like the direction that they're taking it in? And specifically, you know, founder-led companies where the founders have a lot of shares in it, that's the question we have to ask.
Yeah.
So there isn't a one-size-fits-all for any kind of governance structure. And there are advantages to that founder-led structure as well. I don't know, Simon, do you want to say any more about Alphabet's situation?
Yeah, look, all I'd say is, in, you know, the kind of minority, we like minority shareholders to have influence, but we think the way that Google, Alphabet have run their business, they do it because they're trying to look after the long term. So we believe there's a benevolence to the way they run their business. If we felt that they were trying to, you know, really screw over minority shareholders, you know, we'd probably be less keen to hold the business. But also, remember, it's ESG, environmental, social, and governance. So governance, definitely, we still give it a markdown on Alphabet. But the social aspect, we think they're good. You know, they treat their people very, very well, which is, you know, their key asset for Alphabet is their people, you know, the engineers. Really the key asset, and they do look after them. And from an environmental perspective, they're actually really good. They're one of the, you know, they're the biggest buyer of renewable energy in the world, Alphabet. So the way they run, you know, right. The way that the energy is used within the technology sector is a really important aspect of the way that the kind of world works and the way we consume energy within our economy. And there's very few better at it at managing this impact than Alphabet. So it's really managing those three together. That's all I kind of wanted to say in terms of the way we approach sustainability of an individual business.
Okay, thanks. Pros and cons, I suppose. So the funds, as we've alluded to, have been really strong performers in recent years. So the Sustainable Future Global Growth Fund, for example, 142% return in the last 5 years versus 84% for the MSCI World Index, so global markets. Now, that's also been a period when growth stocks, which you tend to invest in, have massively outperformed value stocks. Maybe, Peter, if I can ask you, January saw quite a pullback for tech stocks, particularly in the US, and growth stocks. Are you worried about that continuing and it affecting your funds?
I mean, yeah, it's human to worry. Yeah. January has been quite a violent re-rating of value stocks. But I guess what gives us confidence in the future is that we have been running these strategies for over two decades. And in that period, we have seen episodes like this where 2003, 2009, 2016 all come to mind, where you get a sort of sharp re-rating of value stocks, where perhaps the elastic band has stretched too far for growth. But in the long run, you know, we stick to our belief that we've demonstrated over this time period that the compounding of growth stocks, you know, if you get them right, you know, if you get them wrong, and if they're not growing, then they're not delivering strong returns on that growth, then yeah, it's not going to work. But if you do get those ones, you can identify those ones that are going to compound over the next 5-10 years, then it'll, you know, make episodes like this January or last quarter, basically from October to through to the end of January, look like quite small events overall. So, yeah, okay. That's how we're viewing it.
So you think a blip in the graph rather than a sea change?
Yeah, definitely. And we never sort of, you know, try to adapt our portfolios to shift to a style, you know, because of a change in style. We stick to companies we like, and where they've sold off a lot, we will look to kind of rotate from those that haven't to add back to those positions.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I mean, Simon, have you been bargain hunting or?
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously seen some opportunities within, our own portfolio. So we do that from time to time. We don't trade the portfolio a lot. We try to keep it. It's just kind of the patient capital type approach. But yeah, we have, made basically reinvested some money a couple of times over the last few months in names where we felt that they'd basically borne the brunt of the sell-off without any real fundamental change to the business. And we also, see opportunities and potentially some names that we also might not have in the portfolio yet, which, are at valuation levels where we feel that they're more interesting. So, but obviously there's a degree of due diligence that we do on all these names before we invest in them. So it does throw up opportunities. No fund manager likes to underperform at any ever. It's not how we're built, but when you've been doing it for as long as we have, we respect the fact and see the opportunities that are there. And in the next kind of 12 months or 2 years or 3 years or 5 years, you often look back at these little periods of time as great opportunities for your investors and your portfolio.
Yeah. Any specific areas that you think are starting to look attractive?
I think obviously there's lots of areas within things like technology and healthcare that have borne the brunt. I mean, I think what's interesting, for us is what we're slightly focusing on is I think that, unprofitable companies had been, doing very, very well for a long period of time. They've really borne the main brunt of the sell-off. We're interested in profitable companies that within our investment horizon do become profitable. We really focus on that type of company where the long-term profitability and returns of the business are very, very high, but potentially short-term, they might be reinvesting or they might be at a slightly earlier stage. And, we think that that presents us an opportunity. So, we respect the fact that, unprofitable companies can't, perform forever, but we focus on those ones that are going from unprofitable, profitable within our 5-year time horizon. And that's where, we think the real opportunity might come, in the next 5 years.
Interesting. And to change tack again, if that's all right. So Peter, your guys' experience and strong record from the fund has won a lot of new customers in recent years. The sustainable investment franchise at Liontrust has swelled to nearly £15 billion of assets, I think, and £3 billion 3 years ago, it was more like £3.3 billion. So a lot of inflows. Have managing all those inflows challenged your investment process?
No, not really. I mean, just to kind of characterize, on our global equity funds, we start with a minimum market cap of $2 billion US dollars, so all the way up to Alphabet. So there's ample kind of room in terms of capacity to kind of grow the strategies, and that's where we've seen the strongest growth has been into global equities and our multi-asset funds. Our UK strategies are they kind of start a bit smaller, so around about $1 billion. I mean they're kind of fine in terms of growth. We can kind of see room for them to grow, significantly from here, but they're not funds that you could liquidate overnight.
Right.
And that's something we make clear to our investors because we have got mid-cap holdings in there and stuff. But equally, as you'll know, UK equities has not been the growth asset of choice, and we see the bulk of the growth of the funds continuing to go into global equities, multi-asset and corporate bond and European equities.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, my next question was going to be, at what point do you have to think about closing funds or soft closing funds? But it sounds like you think you're very far from that point.
Yeah, we're very far from that point, and our view is that we just always want to make clients aware of, all the risks around the fund. These are actively managed funds with a very high active share. One of those risks is liquidity risk, which eventually, and so we kind of make them aware of the liquidity characteristics of the portfolios.
Yeah.
So we don't really see the need to ever kind of contemplate thinking about closing or soft closing.
Sure. Okay. Simon, if I can turn back to you, Well, slight surprise last year, given these other trends we've been talking about and how popular this area has been with investors, was last year you wanted to launch a Lion Trust ESG investment trust, but it didn't raise quite enough money to get off the ground. What went wrong there from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we created a product that we thought was interesting to, you know, the closed-end market. I think what we kind of found out that was that the people who buy closed-end products and people who buy open-ended products are often the same people. And obviously the success, you know, particularly this is a global product within our, you know, global products in the open-ended space, as you say, we went from, you know, 3.3 to 15, and, you know, a large chunk of that growth had come in global. So I think what we found is that, you know, a lot of these investors actually, you know, had, you know, products or had investments within, you know, our product range, and we're very, very happy with that. We it was, you know, slightly differentiated, but, you know, clearly you can't come up with something completely different. You know, we kind of do what we do and we apply the process within the, you know, within that market. We kind of did make it a bit more kind of, you know, mid-cap, some smaller opportunities, but, you know, I think, you know, all in all, I think that you know, a lot of investors had said, look, you know, we love your product, but we already have exposure and we're really happy with the product that we have. So, you know, we accept that. We tried to create a product that, you know, assuming there was demand for it there, and if investors are happy with the products that we have, then, you know, we're absolutely happy with that. And
And is running an investment trust one day still an ambition?
I think we've tested the water, and we're comfortable sticking with our open-ended funds.
Okay, sure. And if we can stay with you, Peter, one holding that struck me in your UK fund was Legal & General. You know, the massive life insurance company, which seems to rather stand out from your other kind of tech and healthcare holdings and so on. Why is that company a sustainability success story?
Yeah, we sort of are distinctive in our approach in that we do have sort of financial services companies within our portfolios. We did a piece of work which was looking at what a sustainable economy would consist of, and it's clear you have to have a well-functioning financial services company. And the theme which Legal & General fits into is this idea of saving for the future. Mm-hmm. Particularly as you see governments and businesses rolling back from providing for their employees, so, you know, no defined benefit pension funds, you know, governments reducing the amount of social security around the world. So you need, private companies to come and do this as efficiently as possible. And so Legal & General fits that theme around saving the future. They do it, we think, in a particularly progressive way. And what we particularly like is the way that they invest in kind of direct assets. So they're, you know, they're building houses in the UK. They're investing behind renewable energy, smart grids. Right. So these long-lived investments to generate a strong return into the future. And so that's why it fits within this strategy.
Yeah. And one more question on your UK holdings, if that's right. So I think it will be of interest to our audience. I saw you've got some smaller stakes in a couple of investment trusts yourself. So biotech investment vehicles, Syncona, I think also venture capital fund Molten Ventures, which used to be called Draper Esprit. What is it about these UK investment trusts which makes them a kind of nice source of sustainable ideas?
Well, we don't blanket like UK investment trusts. What we're looking for is to invest behind something that we couldn't get access to in another way. And so just to take the Syncona example, we believe the next decade is just going to be so exciting for biotech. I mean, we saw in the speed with which the vaccines were developed, just how revolutionary the technologies have become.
Yeah.
Syncona is a backer of businesses that are developing gene therapies. And gene therapies have the capability to do a sort of one and done solution to kind of cancers, to inherited diseases like cystic fibrosis and for other sort of illnesses like Parkinson's, where there's a sort of faulty gene fault. And they have a phenomenal track record of developing these, and we really back it. And if they have expertise, you know, way beyond what we could deliver in finding those smaller companies, backing them to become successes in the future.
Okay, so it sounds a bit like 3i in a way, that this is another way for you to get access to exciting trends in private markets.
Yeah, exactly. But the really important thing is to make sure that the people doing the investment are aligned with what we're trying to achieve, which is to invest behind companies which are helping make our, you know, world cleaner, healthier, safer. So, yeah, and we see that as absolutely the mission of Syncona.
Okay, thanks. Now, Simon, I'd like to circle back to one more sustainability question before you end. You know, we're discussing the kind of companies you hold. There's lots of, I guess, what we might call asset-light businesses in areas like, well, biotech or indeed software, payments. To steal someone else's phrase, they tend to be virtual as well as virtuous. What we don't really have are the likes of travel, leisure, retail, the kind of companies which might employ a lot of people and also have really struggled during the pandemic. Long term, are you worried about some kind of conflict between the rise of ESG investing and, well, I guess the labour market?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we specifically try to target companies that have kind of less people. I mean, I think what we really try to focus on is, obviously we're looking for those companies whose products are helping to kind of achieve the aims that we look for. But we also kind of focus a lot on, you know, how a company treats the staff. So in that S, that social kind of part of the focus, we, you know, we feel that for most companies, their people are their most important asset. So, you know, whilst you're right, we do kind of not invest in you know, areas such as travel and leisure. I mean, it's not all kind of software and technology. I did, you know, earlier I spoke about the breadth by which we invest. We invest in companies like, you know, Compass Group, for instance, which is a caterer. They employ, you know, thousands and thousands of people. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, that there really is a focus away from, you know, companies that employ people, but more a focus on, you know, making sure that employees are, you know, being treated properly, that the asset that they're treated as, you know, important assets. And that's a really important, you know, aspect of, you know, helping to, you know, create a more sustainable economy as well.
Yeah.
And if I could just add on to that, because one of the other aspects we haven't actually spoken much about, but is the way we engage with businesses and our relationship as sort of owners of part of the business. And I was having a conversation with one of our UK companies, with the CEO of the company, and I was asking him about his experience, because we've been kind of engaging with them to do more on environment and with their employees. And
what sector is the company in?
In industrial.
Okay.
Industrial company, and it was just, I mean, it doesn't really matter the name of the company, but just to sort of characterize it, what he said was, he said, well, I guess initially, you know, I was fine with the environmental stuff. I thought maybe the engaging with the people wouldn't be so you know, useful, but actually the more that they did it, the more they understood that this was the path to success. And that by training and developing their people and getting them on board with the mission of the business, that you end up with a totally different feel to the business. And his view was that this was going to be the kind of, you know, back in the 90s, you had all these management sort of Six Sigma and lean manufacturing and all of these, the kind of how you work with your employees is going to be that equivalent for kind of the coming decades in terms of defining what a successful business is.
Okay, interesting.
Particularly in this era of very low you know, availability of skilled staff that you're seeing, you know, across the world.
Yeah. Okay, well, on that note, I think that's all we've got time for today. So, yeah, well, last thing to say from me is, well, Peter, Simon, thanks so much for coming on. And yeah, really interesting to hear more about what you do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Fantastic. Thank you. And last thing to say, I suppose, is thank you very much, everyone at home, for listening today. And please look out for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts soon.